gentlemen, and I thank you for the drink. She looked directly at Pearly then. I'm sure I could show you a good time. But I don't want to catch hoof-and-mouth disease. Certain they were putting her on about that. She figured he would now set her straight if he was a potential customer for her services. Before Pearly had an opportunity to respond, they heard a loud outburst at the poker table she had recently left. "Damn the luck!" The Kansas cowhand named Riker exploded as he watched another large portion of his recent payday disappear. "And damn this game!" He pushed his chair back and stood up. "That's it for me. I've got better things to do with the money I've got left." With a firm idea what that was, he stormed over to the table where Liz was sitting and grabbed her arm. "Come on," he ordered. "I'm ready to get out of here." In spite of having decided to get up only seconds before, Liz changed her mind immediately. "Get your paws off of me," she demanded, and jerked her arm free. "You lost all your money playing cards, so now you come to me with empty pockets? Ain't nothing free around here. Besides, I'm busy visiting with some gentleman friends now. Go bother one of the other girls." "The hell I will," Riker roared back and tried to grab her arm again. Again she snatched it away. "Go away, Riker. I don't want anything to do with you." Still, he refused to leave her. The three Gates brothers sat immobile for a long moment, fairly astonished by the unexpected encounter between Liz and Riker. But before Riker could grasp her arm again, Reuben spoke. "Appears to me the lady doesn't very much want to go with you, Riker. Least, it looks that way. What do you think, John? Does it look that way to you?" "Well, now that you brought it up, it does kinda look that way," John answered. "Course, they might not be too good with the English language in Kansas. Maybe if he thinks about it a minute, he'll understand she doesn't want to go with him, and he'll go away. What do you think, Pearly?"
"I think when he realizes she doesn't want to go with him, he'll be wanting to apologize for treating her so rough," Pearly said. "He seems like a nice enough fellow when he ain't had too much to drink."
Riker looked in disbelief from one brother to the next as they spoke. "This ain't none of your business," he growled. "This is between me and her. And if you're thinking about making it your business just because there's three of you, then maybe you'd best think again. There's three of my partners sitting at the table over there. So that makes it 4-3.
John nodded slowly as he appeared to be thinking over what Riker had just pointed out.
"By Ned, he's right. 4 Kansas cowboys against 3 Texans. That's an even match, all right."
"I'll go with him," Liz said. "I don't want to be any cause of getting you boys in a fight. You didn't call any of this down on yourselves. I invited myself to your party."
"Well now," Pearly said, reluctant to see her having to submit to the crude cowhand. "We've been enjoying your company. So why don't you stay here with us? I'll pay you whatever you charge for a tussle, and all you have to do for it is sit here and talk. That'd be all right, wouldn't it?"
When she looked undecided, Pearly nodded toward Riker, who was obviously fuming.
"Look at old Riker there. He's thinking he's a gentleman, too, and wants to do the right thing by you. Ain't that right, Riker?"
"Why, you crazy son of a bitch," Riker blurted, and lunged toward Pearly.
Pearly's chair toppled over under the sudden weight of both men, landing them on the floor with Riker on top. With one hand grasping for a chokehold around Pearly's neck, Riker drew his right hand back, cocked to land a wild haymaker. Before he could throw it, his wrist was locked in the powerful grip of John Gates. He was forced to let go of Pearly's throat when his arm was bent backward, threatening to break, effectively peeling him off Pearlie. The painful yelp that bellowed from Riker's mouth served as a call to his three friends at the poker table. Truth be told, none of the three were enthusiastic about participating in a brawl started by Riker, since he was a troublemaker by nature. But seemingly bound by what some might call cowboy honor, they responded to his cry for help and came out of their chairs on the run. John silenced Riker for a brief time with a hard right that sent him skidding on his back, then stood ready with Reuben to meet the charge. In seconds, the two Triple G men were exchanging punches with the men from Kansas. Having seen more than one saloon brawl, Liz backed away quickly, thinking to grab the whiskey bottle from the table as she did. With no time to scramble up from behind the table before the onrush of the three Kansas cowhands, Pearlie dived under it and grabbed the first pair of unfamiliar boots he could get his hands on. Taking a firm grip, he jerked the boots toward him, pulling the surprised cowhand off his feet to land hard on his back. Stunned for a moment, the cowhand was helpless to prevent Pearlie from pulling him out from under the table. "You take care of that one, Pearlie," Reuben yelled when he saw the man disappear just as he was throwing a punch at him. "I got him," Pearlie yelled back. Before the Kansan could collect himself, Pearlie pinned him to the floor with the chair clamped over his chest, sitting on it to keep him trapped. When his opponent tried to fight his way out of his predicament, Pearlie responded with a series of rights and lefts. After a few minutes of this punishment, Pearlie could see the fight draining out of the Kansan, so he asked, "You had enough?"
"I've had enough," the man gasped, clearly helpless to defend himself.
"Fair enough," Pearlie agreed. "If I let you up, we're done, right?"
"We're done," the cowhand agreed. "I didn't want no part of Riker's trouble in the first place."
Pearlie got out of the chair, removed it from the cowhand's chest, then extended his hand to help him up. The timing was such that the contest between the man's two friends and Pearlie's brothers also came to a halt, with both sides calling it a draw. The hostile air seemed to have cleared entirely, with even a grin from a couple of the participants, and there appeared to be a desire for a truce on both sides. The circle of patrons that had formed to watch the brawl dispersed to return to their drinking. The event was passed off by all as a harmless fist fight to vent the hardships of a long trail drive, with the exception of one participant. His head cleared now, after the flush punch that sent him reeling, Riker sought revenge. Revenge that would not be satisfied in a fist fight. While the others were distracted in the process of shaking hands, he quietly drew the .44 Colt he wore and raised it to take aim. He had not yet cocked the hammer back when the whiskey bottle wielded by Liz caught him upside his head, and he collapsed to the floor again.
"Well, I reckon that about signals the end of the drinking," Reuben declared, when he realized what Liz had just done. "I expect everybody's worked up an appetite for supper, so we might as well go on over to the Ogallala house."
"I think we're going to call the card game done," one of the Kansas cowhands said. "We'd best get Riker out of here before he starts more trouble." He turned to Reuben and said, "None of the rest of us was even thinking about pulling a gun."
"I know," Reuben replied. "No hard feelings at all. It was nice getting to know you boys."
That brought a laugh from both sides. Pearlie gave Liz the price of her standard service, telling her that it was worth it in exchange for her action to prevent Riker from shooting one of them.
"You can keep the bottle, too," he said. It was still over half full.
"That's a good bottle. Didn't even break when you hit him in the head."
They stopped to talk to the bartender on their way out of the saloon. Reuben wanted to make sure they left on good terms.
"My name's Reuben Gates. These two are my brothers, John and Pearlie. We set the tables and chairs back up," he told them. "I didn't see that anything got broken."
Billy Fowler, a slim little man with snowy white hair and beard, responded cordially enough.
I appreciate you telling me, Mr. Gates. Most of my customers wouldn't care whether they broke up the furniture or not.
When he said that, something triggered his mind.
Gates, he repeated. Did you say one of your brothers is named Pearly?
That's Pearly, Reuben said, nodding toward him.
Pearly Gates, Billy said. That's a name you ain't likely to forget. If that don't beat all, and I've heard it twice in the last 6 months.
He took another look at Pearly.
Only the first one was a hell of a lot older than you.
He couldn't help noticing the look of surprise registering on their faces.
Is he kin of yours?
Our grandpa, Pearly said. As a matter of fact, we've been trying to find him. Has he settled around Ogallala somewhere?
No, Billy replied. He was just passing through here. Nice old feller. Said he was on his way to see the high mountains while they were still there.
He chuckled when he recalled it.
I don't know where he thought they might be going.
Did he say where in the mountains he was heading? John asked.
Well, no, not exactly. But I think he was talking about Colorado. 'Cause he was asking about the South Platte River. You know, whether it went to the mountains, or should he be on the North Platte?
They talked a while longer to Billy, but soon realized that he had told them all he could about their grandpa's plans. So they thanked him for his help and walked to the Ogallala house to discuss it over supper.
What do you figure the odds of that happening? John remarked.
Ride over 800 miles and strike Grandpa's trail in a saloon.
He shrugged.
Well, we now know he ain't dead.
The question before Reuben and John was what to do about it, if anything. They were not certain, but Pearly was.
I figure this was a sign, just like Mama was talking about. She said we'd find him if we were supposed to, and this is too unlikely to be a coincidence.
I'm thinking I'm supposed to ride to South Platte to Colorado, just like Grandpa did.
Maybe I'll find him in that town we heard about on Cherry Creek. What's the name of it?
Denver, Reuben said. There were a lot of people looking for gold around there. Maybe Grandpa's gone out there to strike it rich. I know you're thinking about what Mama said, telling him about Pa dying. But I don't think she'd expect you to go that far.
It was hard to explain his feelings to his brothers. They wouldn't understand. But he had an overpowering desire to find the old man. The cattle drive was over, so now would be the best time to be away from the ranch, and he was already hundreds of miles closer to Denver here in Ogallala. It was just too much of a coincidence to strike his trail here, and it would have to be a mistake not to continue on. His mind made up, he informed them.
Come morning. I'll be heading west. Reckon you two can find your way back to Lamar County without me.
You're crazy. You know that, don't you?
John replied.
There ain't no telling where that old man ended up.
Yeah.
But I've got to look anyway, to suit myself, Pearly insisted.
Reuben knew better than to try to dissuade him.
So be it, he said. I'll explain to Mama why you didn't come home. She'll appreciate you still looking for him.
I'll take Buck and cut out a pack horse in the morning, Pearly said, already thinking about the supplies he would need.
Make sure you take extra cartridges for that Winchester, John said, and you keep a sharp eye about you.
They spent the night with the rest of the Triple G crew beside a small creek, since there were no rooms available at the hotel. After breakfast the next morning, John and Reuben started back to Texas with most of the men, while Pearly visited Lewis Alfton Gardens General Supply Store to outfit himself for the journey he was determined to take. When he had completed his purchases, he started out on the road right beside the store that led to the South Platte River. Once again, he was looking forward to the adventure, much like he imagined his grandfather had felt as he started out on the same trail. Chapter 5. With a new spirit of adventure, Pearly set out to follow the South Platte to the west as the river wound its way across the seemingly endless prairie. The clerk in the general store, where he bought his supplies, told him that he would have to travel close to 175 miles before he would likely see the mountains on the horizon. The little town called Denver was over 200 miles from Ogallala. Pearlie didn't care. He was in no hurry, the cattle had been delivered to market, and he had a good horse under him and enough money to buy any supplies he might come to need. According to the store clerk, he would come to a fork in the road about 30 miles west of Ogallala, where another trail on the north side of the river headed out a little more to the north. "Make sure you don't take that one," the clerk had said. "You do, and you'll end up in Cheyenne, in Wyoming. About 10 miles beyond that fork is where the town of Julesburg was, before the Indians raided and burned it. You'll know you're on the right trail when you see what's left of it." Pearlie figured the fork in the trail might be a good place to rest his horses. He started the bay gelding out at an easy lope for a couple of miles before letting him settle back to a comfortable walk. He usually let his horses rest after riding about 20 or 25 miles, but it wouldn't be any strain on Buck or the sorrel pack horse he was leading to continue another 5 miles. Neither horse showed any signs of tiring. Although there was a common trail running along the river, he met no one else as he rode. When he approached the spot where the other trail the clerk had mentioned forked off, he could see that it led directly to the riverbank. Pearlie decided to follow it down to the water, but pulled Buck up short when he spotted a couple of horses grazing near the bank. He scanned the trees that lined the river, but saw no one. He decided to proceed, but with caution. So he drew the Winchester from the saddle sling and nudged Buck to move slowly into the trees. He had not gone more than a few yards when a woman suddenly popped out from behind a cottonwood with a pistol aimed at him. He reined back hard, almost making Buck rear up, but the woman didn't shoot. "Stop right there," she commanded. A few feet away, someone stepped out from behind another tree, also holding a gun. Pearlie started to slowly back Buck away. "I said stop," the woman said. "Pearlie Gates?" the second person exclaimed. "It's all right, Stella. I know him." She dropped the pistol down to her side. "You remember me, don't you? I'm Liz from last night." It struck him then. It was Liz, all right. But she was dressed in men's clothes and boots, and her hair was pulled up under a hat. Sizable woman that she was, she looked like a man, standing in the shadow of the tree. "Well, I'll be," he started. "Why were you fixing to shoot me?" "Because we thought you were Kenny Lamb, coming back to see what else he could steal before he killed us," Stella said. "Who's Kenny Lamb?" Pearlie asked as he stepped down from the saddle. Liz explained. "He's a no-account drifter who's been hanging around the saloon. We paid him to take us to Cheyenne. He said he could protect us from any outlaws or wild Sioux renegades. Only trouble is, we needed somebody to protect us from him. He was getting free service to boot. But I reckon that wasn't enough. He wanted to clean us out, and I know he was planning to leave us out here with our throats cut. He didn't figure on us having guns, did he, Stella?" Stella held her pistol up again for him to see, grinning as she did. "He sneaked up on me when I was down in the bushes yonder," Liz continued. "He didn't know that Stella was over behind another bush, and she had her pistol with her. I let out a yell when he grabbed me by the throat, and Stella came to my rescue." She paused to chuckle over the memory. "When Kenny saw her gun, he ran for it." "I shot at him 3 times, Stella said, "but I reckon I can't hit deadly squat with a pistol." "Anyway," Liz went on, "I guess he decided to settle for what he could take on the run. The son of a bitch took off with our pack horse. When we heard your horse whinny, we thought it was him coming back." Pearlie was amazed to hear the woman's story. "What were you going to Cheyenne for?" Liz had said nothing about planning to take an early morning trip when she sat with them the night before. He thought he would have remembered it.
"Well," Liz began, "that's another story. One you already know something about. Seems like I bought a whole lot of trouble for myself when I hit Riker upside the head with that bottle. After they left last night, one of his friends came back to warn me that Riker swore he was going to come after me. His friend, I think his name is Red, said Stryker wasn't fooling, and he thought I'd best find a place to hide. I thought I'd be better off somewhere besides Ogallala. And Stella has a friend that runs the Cattleman Saloon in Cheyenne, so she said she'd go with me."
"Is that why you're dressed up like a man?" Burley asked, since she hadn't offered to explain.
"Yep, that was Stella's idea. She figured if Riker happened to catch sight of us, he'd think she was with a man." "I was planning to go to Cheyenne anyway," Stella said. "It's a bigger town than Ogallala. Me and Liz ought to do real well there."
"I reckon we'll just have to make it to Cheyenne on our own," Liz said. "I know I ain't going back to the cowboy's rest. Hell, we'd most likely be leaving there in a couple of months anyway. Ogallala gets pretty dead in the winter after the last herds are brought in."
"I swear," Pearlie responded, "that's enough bad luck to last for a good while. Did you say this fellow ran off with your pack horse?"
"He did," Liz replied. "And it was already packed up ready to start out, and that's a problem." She looked at Stella, who nodded in agreement. "All our food and cooking supplies were on that horse. Our clothes, frying pans, coffee pot. Didn't leave us anything to start out with. I reckon we ought to thank our lucky stars that our riding horses were down at the water, or we'd be on foot."
Pearlie thought about their plight for a long moment before commenting. "I expect it's 150 miles from here to Cheyenne." He paused again, thinking about his quest to follow his grandfather into Colorado, before reluctantly volunteering. "You can't make that trip without anything to cook, or even to cook with if you had it. I reckon I can see you to Cheyenne. I've got enough bacon and such for the three of us, and if we're lucky we might run up on something to shoot. Of course, that's if you want me to come along." The expressions displayed on both of their faces were answer enough.
"I declare," Stella exclaimed, "I better drop down on my knees right now and thank the good Lord for sending us an angel. Me and Liz was wondering what in the world we was going to do."
"We could have rode back to Ogallala," Liz said, "but I was scared to go back there. I was set on riding to Cheyenne even if I starved to death on the way."
"I'll figure some way to pay you back for taking us. Were you heading that way anyway?"
"No, ma'am," Pearlie replied. "I was going to stay on that other trail into Colorado, heading to Denver."
His remark caused Liz to remember his talking to Billy Fowler, so she asked,
"Is that where you were going to look for your grandpa?"
"Yep, that's where I was aiming to start looking anyway. That bartender said that's where Grandpa was talking about."
"I reckon we're messing up your plans."
She said it as if to apologize, but she was not about to refuse his help.
"No matter," he said. "I'll see you ladies to Cheyenne, then I'll head south to Denver from there. It's going to be a little while before we start out, though. I've got to rest my horses."
While the horses were drinking from the river, Pearlie rebuilt the fire the women had built to cook their breakfast and put his coffee pot on to boil. While they enjoyed his coffee, Stella sought to make his acquaintance.
"I ain't sure I heard right when you first rode up. My getting ready to shoot you and all. What did Liz call you?"
"Pearlie," he answered. "Pearlie Gates."
She paused, not sure, so he answered,
"Like the gates up in heaven, just not spelled the same."
Stella couldn't help chuckling.
"Your mama and your papa
Must had a real sense of humor to put a name like that on a young'un.
I was named for my grandpa, Pearlie said patiently, then repeated the story of how he came to be called Pearlie Gates, an explanation he had given 100 times or more. When he had finished, Stella commented,
Well, that's a right good name for an angel. And that's what me and Liz are going to call you. Angel.
She grinned at Liz, and Liz grinned in agreement.
I reckon I'd rather you call me Pearlie, he said.
It was not yet noon when they crossed over the South Platte and set out on the trail to Cheyenne. Pearlie couldn't help but wonder how he happened to decide the fork in the trail was where he wanted to rest his horses. He had been following the river all the way. He could have stopped anywhere to rest the horses, but he decided to push them another 5 miles. Had he not, he would no doubt never have run into Liz and Stella, and would be on his way to Denver. Another damn cow pie, he thought. But as soon as he thought it, he chastised himself. It was a lucky thing for them that he had come along. They would have been in a hell of a fix on their own. He looked back now at the two women trailing along behind him. They were riding side by side, talking casually, as if out for a Sunday ride or on a picnic. Evidently, they felt their worries were over, with him to take care of them. Of some concern were the horses they were riding. They counted themselves lucky that Kenny Lamb had not had time to steal their riding horses when he absconded with their pack horse. After a quick examination of the two horses, Pearlie was of the opinion that Kenny didn't figure the two nags were worth the effort, and Pearlie agreed with him. He suspected the fellow at the stable who sold them to the women was glad to be rid of them. If they were lucky, the horses would make it to Cheyenne with no trouble. They weren't carrying much of a load, but it was a good 150 miles to Cheyenne. Normally, he would figure that would take about 3.5 to 4 days if he was not in a hurry to get there. He decided he'd best figure a day longer, so as not to make it too hard on their horses. Of the two, Liz's horse, a flea-bitten gray, was in better shape than Stella's sorrel, although it showed signs of aging. The sorrel was pretty gray in the muzzle as well, and had an awkward gait, as if it had sore feet. He had loaded his pack horse with supplies enough to carry him for the long trip, but at the time he hadn't counted on feeding two women. Maybe he thought he was lucky enough to find some game to supplement the sow belly he packed. Water would seem to be no problem, for the trail they rode followed a strong creek. The clerk at the general store had told him it was called Lodgepole Creek, and a traveler could follow it all the way to Cheyenne. Hoping to make 20 miles before resting the horses, Pearlie was forced to stop after what he estimated to be about 15 or 16. Stella's sorrel began to limp soon after they started out, but she wasn't aware that anything was wrong. She said the horse always had a rough gait, ever since they started out from Ogallala, so she didn't say anything about it. No matter, Pearlie told her. There wasn't anything he could do about it, except to rest the miserable horse. "That horse is so old, he's probably got a case of rheumatism or something," he said. "He was the cheapest horse Walter had," Stella said, referring to the owner of the stable in Ogallala. "I had to buy one in a hurry. I didn't own a horse like Liz did." "I let Walter take it out in trade for the price of that horse," Liz said. "This is the first time I've actually rode the damn thing. Walter was still coming to see me 3 or 4 nights a week to pay for the saddle. Said I still owed him $10 on it. I told him I didn't have time to fool with him. I would just tell his wife how I was paying for my horse and saddle." She looked at Stella and giggled. "He yelled, 'Paid in full,' quick enough then." "Well, we'll let the poor old horse rest and see if he is able to go again after that," Pearlie said. "I'll pull the saddle off of him. Maybe that'll help a little." Before turning the horse loose to go to the water with the others, he took a close look at its hooves and legs. He could only come to the same conclusion as before. The horse was old.
The two of them might be riding double before they reached Cheyenne, he thought. The women still had some concern about the possibility of another visit from Kenny Lamb, since they thought he couldn't know that Pearlie had come to their rescue. Pearlie didn't share their concern, because Kenny hadn't left them with anything worth coming back for, unless, he allowed, they were in possession of enough cash money for Kenny to risk getting shot at. "I know it's a little too soon to eat," Pearlie said as he walked back from the edge of the creek to join them. "But would you ladies like to have a cup of coffee, since we're going to be here for a while?" "I was thinking about how good a cup of coffee would be right now, with the wind whipping off of that prairie like it is," Stella replied at once. "I didn't say nothing about it, 'cause I didn't know how much coffee you've got." Pearlie assured her that he had enough to have a little extra while the horses were resting. The problem, he said, was the shortage of coffee cups. He always carried one extra cup, but they would still be a cup short. "Me and Liz can share a cup, can't we, Liz?" Liz nodded. In a short while, they had a fire going and Pearlie's coffee pot working up some fresh coffee. Stella took on the chore of fixing the coffee, and when she poured the two cups, Pearlie insisted that he would wait for his. He had to tend to the horses first. She knew he was just being polite, even though he walked over to the horses and busied himself checking his packs. "First man I've run into in a long time that don't automatically think God put women on earth to serve men," she commented to Liz. "Pearlie's different, all right," Liz replied. "Reckon how long it'll be before he takes a notion that he wants to jump under the blanket with one of us," Stella asked. "And when he does, reckon which one of us he'll pick." "I don't know," Liz said. "Seeing as how you're so much younger and dainty, might be you, might be both of us. I wouldn't be surprised if he don't come sniffing around either one of us at all." "Shoot," Stella scoffed. "He's a man, ain't he? He can't help hisself." Liz shrugged, causing Stella to challenge. "I'd bet a dollar he asks one of us before we get to Cheyenne." Liz smiled. "I'll take that bet, but on one condition. It's no fair for either one of us to ask him if he wants a free one, all right?" "All right. It's a bet," Stella agreed. "I wish to hell we had some sugar to put in this coffee, though." She took another swallow, then refilled the cup, and walked over to the edge of the creek and gave it to him. She walked back to the fire to find Liz grinning at her. "You ain't cheating on me, are you?" Liz chided her. "I hope you ain't afraid of catching hoof-and-mouth disease." Stella responded with a puzzled frown and waited a moment for an explanation. When there was none, she shrugged it off, thinking Liz said a lot of things that didn't make sense, and answered the question. "Hell no," she replied, grinning. "I ain't cheating on you. I thought about it, though." "Something about him, ain't there?" Liz remarked. "I think I'd just like to take him home with me and mother him more than anything else." "Well, when you pay me that dollar, you can mother both of us," Stella said. When Pearlie decided the horses were rested enough, they started out again, hoping to make this segment of the trip longer than the first one had been. Stella's sorrel looked to be traveling better and maintained a decent pace for over 10 miles before it began to show a pronounced limp in its walk. Still, it held to the pace. The critical moment came when the trail crossed a swift stream. In crossing, the horses had to drop down from one bank and scramble up the short bank on the other side. Buck and the pack horse behind him managed it with no difficulty at all, as did Liz's flea-bitten gray. But when Stella urged her sorrel to cross, the horse refused at first. Then, when it decided to jump down the short bank, its front hooves landed solidly on the creek bed. It almost sounded like a rifle shot when the bones in both front legs broke. The injured horse collapsed headfirst into the stream, sending Stella flying over its neck to land on her back on the other side. Liz and Pearlie dismounted as fast as they could to come to her aid. Relieved to find that she had only had the wind knocked out of her, Pearlie went at once to the stricken horse. With no way to comfort the injured sorrel, he was forced with the undesirable task of ending its misery. Seeing the pain in the old horse's eyes, he didn't hesitate to pull his .44 and put a bullet into the sorrel's brain. Startled by the gunshot, both women flinched, with Stella suddenly sitting upright. Liz helped her to her feet, and they both rushed to the fallen animal.
"You shot my horse!" Stella exclaimed. "He didn't mean to throw me."
"I know he didn't," Pearlie said, realizing she still wasn't sure what had happened. "I shot him to put him out of pain. He broke both his front legs, and there was nothing to do for him except shoot him."
"Oh!"
Stella started, then checked herself.
"Well, I understand. You had to do it."
Embarrassed by her outburst, she recovered a moment later when another concern occurred to her.
"I don't have a horse now."
She looked to Liz for help, but even in a moment of tragedy, Liz couldn't help japing her.
"That's mighty tough luck, gal. It's a long walk to Cheyenne," she said. "Ain't it, Pearlie?"
"You and Liz will have to ride double," Pearlie said to Stella. "As light as you are, that gray of hers can handle it without noticing the extra weight." He waded out of the shallow stream to get a rope, then returned to the dead horse and put a loop of the rope around its neck. He tied the other end around Buck's withers, then dragged the carcass out of the stream.
"Ain't no use in fouling the water," he explained to Liz when she asked why.
"I'll get your saddle off of him," he said to Stella. "You can sell it when you get to Cheyenne. I can load it on top of my packs." It took a little more help from Buck before Pearlie managed to get the saddle out from under the horse. Then, with Stella up behind Liz on the gray, they got underway again. Gray Wolf pulled his pony to a stop when he saw the dead horse lying on the other side of the stream. He paused there in the trees until he was sure there was no one else around, before he called out to his friends.
"Over here!" he yelled,
then urged his pony forward to cross the stream. He took another quick look around him before sliding off the horse, and was kneeling beside the carcass of the unfortunate sorrel, when Cripple Horse and Walking Man rode up beside him. Gray Wolf pointed to the bullet hole in the sorrel's head.
"This was the shot we heard. The horse is very old. Maybe that is why they shot him."
"White man," Cripple Horse said when he saw the horseshoes on the sorrel's hooves.
A moment later he said, "The old horse broke his legs. That is why they shot him."
He looked up as if searching for the white men.
"This horse has not been dead for very long. They cannot be very far away. They dragged the horse up out of the water and took the saddle. They cannot be far."
"How many are they?" Gray Wolf wondered. "Maybe soldiers."
Walking Man, who had been studying the ground around the carcass, answered him.
"Not soldiers. Soldiers don't ride old horses like that one. I see tracks that tell me they were probably three more horses, all wearing iron shoes."
"Only three,"
Gray Wolf murmured, thinking out loud.
"Maybe we have found something better to hunt than deer or antelope," he said then. "Where do the tracks lead?"
"They are riding the trail west," Walking Man answered.
"Then I say we are wasting time looking at a dead horse. Let's find these white men and kill them, and take their horses and guns,"
Cripple Horse suggested.
"I think maybe they have guns, and plenty of bullets, if they waste one on this worthless horse,"
Walking Man said.
"They will see us long before we can get close enough for our bows."
He received grunts of agreement from both of his friends, for the trail ahead of them was barren of trees, except for those that lined the creek. The possibility of acquiring guns and ammunition was too great to be ignored, however.
"Walking Man is right," Grey Wolf said. "We must wait until they camp and strike them at night."
"We're wasting time standing here talking about it," Cripple Horse said. "They're getting farther away while we talk." Grey Wolf looked up at the sun.
"It is still a long time before the sun goes down. We have plenty of time to catch up with them."
When his two companions looked skeptical, he said,
"They will still be on this trail. There are no white man settlements between here and Duck Bend."
"I think you are right," Cripple Horse said. "But it would still be a good thing if we can get close enough to see them before it gets dark." There was no disagreement with that, so they jumped on their ponies and started up the trail after the white men. The three lone hunters were but one small group of many Sioux warriors who had refused to go to the reservation after their defeat at the Battle of Wolf Mountain. Vowing never to surrender to the soldiers, the three friends had joined with a few other Lakota Sioux and Cheyenne warriors to live as they had always lived. But the near extinction of the buffalo and the constant pressure from army patrols forced them to retreat into the Rocky Mountains and the harsh winters they found there. Before a year had passed, the band of Indians began to break apart, with most of them reporting to the reservation. Still defiant, Grey Wolf and his two friends moved into the plains of Nebraska and Wyoming, still seeking the buffalo, even after ammunition for the two rifles among them was depleted and bows were their only weapons. They had not met with much success, so they decided to scout the wagon road between Ogallala and Cheyenne, hoping to prey on settlers heading west. Happening upon this small party of whites might give them the opportunity to gain precious cartridges and other supplies, as well as three horses. The warriors started out after them at a spirited lope, hoping to catch up enough to spot them in the distance. In the tireless prairie they rode through, it was necessary to remain far enough behind so as not to be discovered by their prey. It was certain that the white men carried rifles, and the warriors would be no match for them if they were spotted. Walking Man, noted for his sharp eyes, rode a little ahead of his two friends, his focus concentrated on the trail ahead as it disappeared into the horizon.
"There!" he exclaimed, after they had ridden for half an hour. He pulled up and waited for Grey Wolf and Cripple Horse to catch up to him.
"I see them." His companions nodded, seeing the tiny images on the road far ahead.
"We must fall back, so they don't see us."
For any chance of success, they had to wait until the party had camped and darkness had set in. To attack before then would be suicide against their rifles.
"We should keep up with them. If we cross over to the other side of this creek and use the trees beside it for cover," Walking Man said.
His suggestion was met with approval, for the trees along the creek were the only trees for as far as the eye could see. And even with the many winding curves the creek took, they could easily shorten the distance between themselves and their targets. The sun was starting to settle down upon the horizon by the time Pearlie decided both the horses and the women had traveled enough for that day. So when they came to a point where the creek left the trail to take a wide bend before rejoining it, he decided it would be a good place for their camp. There was a large patch of grass within the loop of the creek bend that promised good grazing for the horses, and there were cottonwoods on both banks that provided an abundance of firewood. A couple of hundred yards north of the trail, a long, grass-covered ridge rose above the rolling prairie beyond. The women went to work immediately, gathering wood for the fire, while Pearlie took care of the horses. He hobbled the pack horse and Liz's gray to make sure they didn't stray during the night. He never hobbled Buck. It wasn't necessary, because the big bay gelding never strayed far from him. Pearlie's brother John used to say the horse had a foolish crush on Pearlie, even claiming that Buck would break away from the remuda on a cattle drive and chase after Pearlie when he was working another horse. In short order, Liz and Stella had coffee boiling and sow belly frying in the pan. Using Pearlie's supplies and the few utensils he owned, Liz mixed up some pan biscuits to go with it. "If we had one more cup, we'd be dining in style," Stella declared. "And maybe a little sugar," Liz added. "Maybe tomorrow I could ride in the saddle and you ride behind," Stella commented. "We'll see," Liz teased. "You're mighty lucky I was kind enough to let you ride behind me." Pearlie shook his head, amazed by the carefree air of the two women, when only a few hours before they were stranded on the prairie, fearing for their lives. Thoughts of a return by Kenny Lamb were forgotten, and the Kansas cowhand named Riker was growing even fainter with each mile traveled from Ogallala. Watching from the cover of a clump of laurel bushes on the other side of the creek, Walking Man was surprised to see two men and a woman as they made their camp for the night. From his angle he could see three saddles, and one of them appeared to have a rifle stock showing. "Cripple Horse will be happy to hear this," he thought, "since he does not have one." His next thought was to hope they had plenty of cartridges, and that he and his friends could kill them before they had a chance to use them. Walking Man was careful to take in every detail of the camp, where the bedrolls were positioned and where the horses were left to graze. Again he was pleased with what he saw. The patch of grass where the three horses were peacefully grazing was close to the road, and they would be easy to steal. He was sure that, had they not planned to kill the white men, it would be a simple thing to slip in that night and ride away with the horses without the owners knowing they were gone. One of the horses especially caught his eye, the big bay. "That is the one I will steal," he thought. Already the shadows were growing long, so he thought he should get back to his friends. They were sure to be getting impatient by now. Slowly he started to back carefully away from the bushes, when he suddenly stopped and lay as flat as he possibly could. The woman and one of the men had gotten up from the fire and started walking toward him. Had they seen him? He was trapped if they continued to advance his way. They both wore handguns, but neither one had drawn one, so maybe he had not been discovered. A few moments later he breathed a sigh of relief, for they turned toward a larger group of laurel bushes directly across the creek, no more than 20 yards from where he lay hiding. He realized then that they were simply seeking privacy from the other man to perform their calls to relieve their bowels. He watched as they made their preparations, and was further surprised when he realized they were both women. One of them, a large woman, was simply dressed as a man. Walking Man almost blurted out his surprise upon discovering their attack was to be against one man and two women. It was too much to have hoped for. Of course, there was still some caution to take because of the guns, but the odds were now heavily in the warrior's favor. In his excitement, it was difficult to remain still until the women had finished and walked back to the fire. When they had gone, he made his exit back into the cottonwoods where he had tied his horse. Then, shielded by the cover of trees along the creek bank, he rode back about a quarter of a mile to report his findings to Gray Wolf and Cripple Horse. Chapter 6
"Only one man?" Gray Wolf questioned. "When we spotted them on the road, they were too far away to tell. Are you sure the other two are women?"
"I saw them when they went to the bushes," Walking Man insisted. "I know the difference between a man and a woman," he added sarcastically.
"Are you sure?" Cripple Horse couldn't resist joking. "We have been away from the village a long time now."
When Walking Man ignored him, he asked,
"Are you sure they have only one rifle?"
"I can't be sure," Walking Man said. "But the saddles were all easy to see, and there is only one that had a rifle showing in the strap, where they usually carry them."
He went on to tell them that the only problem would be if one of them remained alert while the others slept.
"The creek is wide where they camped, and we would have to cross it to attack them. If we were discovered before we got across, it would be bad for us."
He gave them a few moments to consider that before continuing.
"If we were interested only in stealing their horses, it would be an easy thing to sneak in and take them, because they are not far from the road."
"But that does not give us what we need," Cripple Horse said. "They will still have their guns."
"If the horses are as easy to take as you say," Grey Wolf said, "maybe we should steal them first and leave the white devils on foot. Then they could never run very far from us, and we could watch them for a chance to get close enough for our bows to be effective."
He looked at Walking Man and repeated,
"If their horses are as easy as you say."
"There is a high ridge on the north side of the trail," Walking Man replied. "Now that it is almost dark, we can ride up the back of that ridge and see the camp. After they have gone to sleep, it will be easy to go down and take the horses."
Cripple Horse looked at Grey Wolf and nodded. It seemed the safest way to attack the camp. If afterward they had failed to kill their prey, at least the warriors would have three fine horses. So they jumped upon their ponies and rode east far enough to cross over the road and circle around to the back of the ridge. Unaware of the danger threatening them, the occupants of the camp took their time to wash the frying pan and spoons. The women, apparently free of worry over who might be chasing them from Ogallala, were enjoying the last of the coffee. There was no thought in Pearlie's mind concerning the threat of an Indian attack. It had been a fairly long time since there were reports of any hostile activity in the area, most all of the surviving holdouts against the reservations having been captured. Luckily for the women, their bedrolls were tied behind their saddles, so they didn't lose them when Kenny Lamb rode off with all their other supplies. Using the saddles for pillows, they turned in for the night, planning to get an early start in the morning. As a matter of practice, Pearlie kept his Winchester handy. Plus, he counted a lot on Buck's senses to alert him in the event of an emergency. It wasn't long, however, before all three were surrendering to the music of the crickets and other creatures that dwelt along the creek bank. At some point late that night, Pearlie was awakened. He did not realize at once that he had been alerted by the faithful gelding, hearing only the low mumbling of Liz, apparently in a deep dream. He lay there listening for only a moment more before he heard the unmistakable sounds of alarm from Buck. He reacted immediately. Grabbing his rifle and rolling away from the fire, he scrambled up to his feet and ran to the horses. What he discovered in the darkness of a moonless night might be considered humorous later on when retelling it, but at the time it was a desperate attempt to save the horses from being stolen. In the moments before, Walking Man had leaped upon the back of the bay gelding he admired, while Grey Wolf and Cripple Horse had jumped onto the other two horses. Buck promptly screamed his defiance and launched a stiff-legged dance of the devil, making short work of the would-be thief's ride. The surprised Indian was thrown head over heels to land on his back, while the bay ran toward the camp and his master. While Walking Man was being introduced to Buck, Grey Wolf and Cripple Horse, not having noticed that their mounts were hobbled, began flailing and kicking them frantically when they refused to gallop. When the first shot from Pearlie's rifle cracked over their heads, it was incentive enough for them to come off the horses. Pearlie's second shot inspired them to run for their lives and their own horses, waiting at the foot of the ridge. Walking Man followed close behind in spite of extreme difficulty in getting his breath, a result of landing solidly on his back. Pearlie followed for a little way until convinced the thieves were not stopping in their escape. To encourage them, he fired one more shot over their heads. Then he gathered the horses and led them back closer to the camp and tied them there.
"Thanks, partner," he said to Buck as he rubbed the big bay's neck. Then he prepared to give an accounting to the two women, who were both lying flat on their stomachs, their pistols out, and using their saddles for cover. Not waiting for his explanation, Liz blurted, "What the hell was that? Was it Kenny?"
"No," Pearlie answered. "It was just some Indians doing what Indians do. They were figuring on stealing our horses, but they didn't know Buck was on duty. I reckon I should have been on the lookout for somebody trying to take the horses, but I didn't figure on any trouble with Indians. I'll try to be a little more careful from now on. Sorry it spoiled your sleep, but I think you can go on back to it. You won't be bothered the rest of the night. I'll stay awake, just in case."
"The hell you say?" Stella immediately responded. "There ain't no way I'm going back to sleep with those bastards sneaking around in the dark."
"The same goes for me," Liz declared. "I'm up for good. I've heard some tales about what those savages do to white women." She held her pistol up. "And this ain't going back in the holster till daylight, and I can see a mile around me."
"Well, I reckon I might as well liven up this fire a little, and we'll make another pot of coffee," Pearlie said.
"Might be a good idea to set back a ways from the fire, though. Don't want to give 'em too good a target, just in case."
He scratched his head thoughtfully. "They didn't put up any fight at all. I figure they don't have any guns, and all they had in mind was stealing the horses."
While the victims of their attack prepared to wait out the night, the vanquished raiders pulled their ponies to a halt after galloping to the north side of the ridge, where they stopped to review their ill fortune.
"This was a foolish plan," Cripple Horse complained. "We are lucky one of us is not dead. We should have attacked the camp. They were all asleep. We could have killed them all while they slept."
"I don't think so," Grey Wolf disagreed. "The one with the rifle rolled out of his blanket immediately. We would have all been killed if we had rushed in."
He looked to Walking Man for confirmation.
"You saw him grab his rifle, didn't you?"
"No," Walking Man answered. "I was watching the horses."
This was true. Because he was so eager to get to the bay gelding first, he wasn't watching the camp at all.
"I think we would have gotten away with the horses if Walking Man had not caused that bay horse to buck and make the noise that gave us away," Cripple Horse said. "Maybe Grey Wolf or I should have ridden that horse."
"I ride as well as any man," Walking Man retorted in anger. "That horse is crazy. You and Grey Wolf could not even make those other two horses run."
"Their legs were tied," Grey Wolf exclaimed in their defense. "They could not run."
"Anyone knows a horse can't run if his legs are tied," Walking Man replied. "You should have untied them before you tried to ride them."
"It was too dark to see that they were tied," Cripple Horse replied. "There was no time, anyway, with all the noise when that horse threw you off."
"It is done," Grey Wolf asserted. "Our plan didn't go well, and it does no good to argue among ourselves. We must talk about what we will do now."
"Grey Wolf is right," Walking Man said. "Let's make our plans to kill those three whites and take their horses and guns. I want to teach that crazy horse to obey."
They talked it over for a short time, and all three agreed that there would be no honor in abandoning their original plan to kill the whites. And they desperately needed their guns and ammunition. Since there was very little time left before sunrise, they decided to ride farther up the trail to get ahead of the white party. Then, when it became light enough to see, they could find a good spot to ambush them. All agreed
so they rode along the back of the ridge to the end of it before returning to the wagon road and continuing west. When the first rays of the sun began to melt the shadows near the creek, Pearlie saddled Buck and told Liz and Stella that he wanted to make